Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we hear from a Brock Professor of Information Systems at the Goodman School of Business about how to deal with the bane of your email account, phishing scams. We talk to David Sharon, Head of Special Collections and Archives at Brock, about his new collection launched recently on autism spectrum disorder. And we chat with graduate student Brittany Dunbar, who was the grand prize winner in the recent OCUFA We Teach Ontario video contest. Drawing inspiration from faculty and students alike, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. A little bit of technology to begin the program today. Recently, Canada's Competition Bureau warned Canadians about an array of internet and social media scams that aim to defraud Canadians. We've all heard about these. Most of these scams come by way of emails from a familiar, usually trustworthy source, such as a bank, where you have an account. But there are plenty of other so-called phishing scams out there we need to be aware of. Brock University researcher Teju Herath, a professor of information systems in the Goodman School of Business, joined us in our CFBU studios recently to talk about some of these scams and what we can do to safeguard ourselves in an ever-increasing minefield of email and social media risks. I asked Professor Herath if she herself had ever been taken in by one of these phishing scams.
I've not been victimized because I have not responded, but I have got tons of them in my inbox. So, yes, we do get really a lot of emails with a variety of scams and a variety of threats.
And that's the key, if you respond to it.
Yes.
And I guess for a lot of people, it's the natural inclination to respond to something if it's got a familiar name attached to it.
Yes.
If it's someone
Most
you know,
likely, yes.
You don't always think, okay, there might be something wrong with this.
Exactly.
So what would be the warning signs?
Well, warning signs, many of us do not check the details of the email headers, and email headers give us a lot of information, whether it is coming from the authentic entity, like the company that you are familiar with or the person you are familiar with. But, you know, these scammers are also getting more and more proficient, so they spoof, and somehow that's how the deception takes place, that we are made to believe that it's coming from the place or from a person that we know, but in fact it's not coming from them.
One of the tip-offs for me with email is if it says it's going to undisclosed recipients.
Yes.
Of which I'm one.
Exactly.
That, to me, is immediate alarm bell right there.
Yes, and sometimes when you do reply to, we can get that additional information and we can check on that. And we have to also take a moment to think whether really would this person want me to give out this information. And more the banks and companies are now telling people that we will never ask you your account information through email. There are a variety of other kind of incidences where it seems like the email is coming from the company you work with or organization you belong to, such as university, and it's asking your username and password. And more we see that emails telling us that we will never ask you this information, right? So we need to keep that at the back of our mind and reflect before we reply to that email.
I know that in the early going, most of those would come purportedly from a bank or another financial institution.
Yes.
And I had one recently from a bank that I've never dealt with in my life. So that was an immediate tip-off.
Exactly.
This is not a good email.
Yeah.
But now they're going after, like, for example, my internet provider. I would get one saying that there's a problem with my account.
Exactly.
You know, so them.
Yes.
It can come in almost any form now. That's why you have to be so careful.
Yes. And like you said, Mike, the earlier emails were very much like Nigerian scams. So somebody has passed off and they have left this chunk of money for you. And they were a bit easy to see that they were deceptions. But still, a lot of older people used to give the money to these charity scams and Nigerian scams. Then these kind of emails evolved over time, asking your account information, mostly targeting the banks. And this kind of scams we call, it's a specific category which we call phishing scams. And later on, these scams evolved to target your Amazon or PayPal kind of accounts. And now we see, like you said, the ISP or your service provider or even the companies you work with or the organization you belong to, basically it seems like it's coming internally from your company and it's asking username, password. Now, the activity that will be carried out with this information varies. If it is a banking information, of course, you're going to see your accounts drained, right? Or your credit cards being used. When your username passwords are asked, then the activity is different. It's used for getting into your account and perhaps do some malicious activity using your account. So trace ends with you. So that is kind of a various scams that we see. What you saw in that particular report that came a few days ago on Global Mail was emails that were used to basically send viruses. Now that has been happening for a very long time, that we see that email is coming from our friend and they're sending us a photograph or some kind of an image. You click on it and there is a Trojan that is installed on your computer. So that has happened for a very long time, but email is most used vector for the spread of all these malicious software.
Yeah, I get a lot of them through email, but I'm finding an increasing number of them. And in fact, I had one just yesterday through Twitter.
Exactly.
And it almost always says the same thing. And the one I had yesterday was, ha ha, is this really you?
Yes.
And it's a name of someone, a colleague of mine that I work with.
Exactly.
Now, my first inclination, since we had had some contact within the past day or so, was to click on it.
Yes.
But there was something in my head that said, no, it's not quite right.
Exactly.
So I waited until I got through everything else at the end of the day. And then I emailed him, regular email last evening. And I said, was your Twitter account hacked? Because I got this and I haven't clicked on it. He says, yeah, it has. It's spam.
Exactly.
Don't open it. So those things I find interesting because you have to be really critical when you see those. But the natural inclination is they're playing on your curiosity.
Exactly.
Because if you get one that says, here's someone who said something really terrible about you.
Yes.
I've had those.
Yes.
You naturally want to find out what it is.
Yes.
I want to stop that.
Yes.
But it just lures you right in.
Exactly.
And I'm finding Twitter is the vehicle of choice with a lot of these now.
Not only Twitter. I think various social networking sites are vehicles now. And like you said, that if the email comes from somebody you know, you're more likely to do it. Now, that is even overwhelmingly exponential in social networking, because in social networks, you normally interact with the people in your trusted network, your friends and families, even like Facebook or other social networks. So if then email comes saying, click on this link, it's really interesting, or click on this thing, it's really funny, like you said, haha.
Like a funny
and you
video.
Know, exactly. And you're going to be, your guards are not going to be completely on, because of course you are dealing with people in a very trusted network. So you're not going to look at it very critically. So that's why many security advocates and managers are really very concerned about what's happening on social networking, because it has even more deception potential.
Are university students more susceptible to this? I wonder if, A, they might get more of these than anyone else, and B, their reaction to it, since they're so used to using social media themselves, they don't always look at it with as critical an eye as perhaps they should.
The answer is we don't know enough about it yet. And, you know, there is not enough statistics available to comment on it. We really do not know the profile of people who tend to be more vulnerable to these incidences. I do have some ongoing research where I get the different kind of people, so students and employees, which basically also belong to different age groups. But we don't yet have that kind of insight as to who will tend to be more vulnerable. I would say that, like you said, maybe students students interact more, perhaps they will be more vulnerable to this, but perhaps they are more aware of these kind of issues and they will be less likely to respond to this. And people like you, me, who are only interacting on the social media very rarely, sporadically, perhaps we will just click on it because that's the moment for our interaction with the other. So very little is known to give any specific notion on this.
So they're really not targeting any particular age group in particular. It's whomever they can get.
Yes. And like we said, that these trends are changing. Of course, when we were looking at earlier scams, they wanted the money. And there is a specific group who will have that kind of money, right? So of course, they will be targeting these people. When it moved to Amazon PayPal, they probably were looking at the people who are doing more online kind of transaction. Again, there is certain statistics available about which people are doing more online transaction, and of course they are going to be more vulnerable to those kind of scams. But these scams which we are talking now, Twitter or social networks, yes, I think social networks are used by a wide range of people. There is no age discrimination, and there have been various studies that show actually middle-aged people, older age group, people from all sorts of age groups, housewives or working people, they all tend to use these networks. So no clear trend yet or pattern that we know yet.
A lot of them, as we mentioned, are supposedly from banks, and they're not, of course. So what should people do if they do click on one of these and something happens? What's the first thing they should do?
They should right away report to the company. That means if you clicked on, let's say, your what you thought was your email coming from your bank, and right away you realize, no, this was something wrong, right? Report to your bank that this has happened so that they can right away close your accounts or take a appropriate action. Similarly, if let's say you were asked your username password from your internet service provider and you mistakenly gave it away, call your service provider right away and indicate that this has happened, right? So that they can take appropriate action. And most often these entities also will then provide you additional guidelines on what you should do. Sometimes the impact is much more severe. It can be identity theft. So the banks can let you know what are the additional steps you should take to revive that. Sometimes it may not be as severe. And so that particular entity, company or organization will be able to guide you to the further steps that you need to take.
So if one of these phishing scams successfully gets into your bank account and cleans out your bank account, what's your liability in that regard? The bank, I would think, would be forgiving to a certain point, but they can't recover all of your funds.
No, they cannot. And that's the thing, that there are certain best practices told when you are doing online transactions. That's why they say that credit cards tend to be more secured, in the sense that if a credit card number is stolen, they will try to give you back a certain amount of money. But if it is the checking account or your debit card, then banks normally do not really make any compensation. So that is something that we have to keep in mind, not to use too much of checking information or your debit cards, but credit cards tend to be more protected in that sense.
So if you don't use your debit card, for me personally, I rarely use my debit card.
Exactly.
I use it when I go to the bank to access my accounts at the teller.
Exactly.
But I rarely will use an automatic teller machine.
Yes.
I can't even remember the last time I did. Yes. So in a store, I never use it.
Exactly.
I just don't use my debit card.
Mm-hmm.
So that would, I would think, lessen your chances of that being a problem.
Exactly. You are more protected in that sense.
Okay. As far as the emails are concerned, how effective are, generally speaking, computer security programs that you would install to help to thwart threats like these?
They are quite effective. Certainly much better than not using one, right? And in some of our research, we have tried to examine whether people tend to use this software and what are their tendencies and what are their initial attitudes in using such a software, whether they find it hassle or whether they find it a useful tool. And that also is based on how much we think email is risky. So again, it goes to that premonition of whether we think, first of all, the email would be risky. Of course, when we get bombarded with so many spam emails, we find the spam filters to be quite good. Like, we don't want to see 100 150, 200 emails in our email box early in the morning. So if the spam filter is taking out most of that chunk, we find it very useful. And a lot of these email scams, of course, get caught in those spam filters. Most of even free email tools like Yahoo Mail or Gmail, I saw one of the new Gmail product. It was focused on just the bulk of emails that we get that you want to sort, which are more important to you. They are advertising that new Gmail product right now. So certainly these tools can help us much better than if we don't have any of these technologies. But again, it depends on how much we use.
That and also being very careful yourself. You can't rely on the program to do it all for you. You have to do it yourself.
Exactly. Because email filters also, I mean, if it is coming from your bank, let's say perpetrately, and email filters, if they find that there is things are spoofed, of course, they're going to find it as a spam email. But if it is really coming from your bank, you don't want it to be basically go to your junk email box or your spam email folder, right? So certainly, these filters have this dual thing to do, and not everything is going to be caught by the spam filter. Really, if that link has come from your friend, or perhaps that message on your social network has come from your friend, but really has that infected thing, then how do you deal with that? So certainly, technologies will not do it all. And like you said, we also have to stop and think before we do something. And it's often thought out in information systems discipline. It's well accepted thing that technologies cannot protect us 100%, right? You need technologies, procedures, but most importantly, people. People play the biggest role in security.
Now, people are far more mobile within the last few years with their communication than they used to be. And I'm finding that a lot of things are coming through your smartphones.
Yes.
And a lot of people aren't necessarily thinking about the security measures that you should take regarding your smartphone.
Yes.
And it's so obvious. I mean, we're all checking our email, Facebook or Twitter, on an ongoing basis throughout the day. For a lot of people, your smartphone is a sitting duck if you don't have any protection on that phone as well.
Exactly. The mobile technology is even adding another layer of complexity to all these issues. Like you said, if we were interacting on all these different media outlets only through our laptops, perhaps it will be sufficient for us to know privacy security settings, for instance, on social network. If you're, we all know that Facebook and all these social networks go through revamping their product every now and then, and every time there is some product feature added or some setting that is changed, and many of these companies have really come on fire because of not letting people know exactly what it means. And for a naive user, for a general user, it's very difficult to decipher all those settings, what they mean. And like you said, on mobile technologies like smartphone, it even is more complicated. And there is a lot of research going on in mobile computing use and difficulties in setting up privacy settings on your smartphones and things like that. So yes, we are entering in an era which is even making us more vulnerable. So we have to strategize on how to secure ourselves.
It's not that difficult. You just have to make the effort and
to learn.
To learn what you have to do and just be vigilant on an ongoing basis with your computer, your laptop, your smartphone, whatever. So if you had one piece of advice to give people about avoiding scams and being hit by a scam, what would you suggest?
If I have to give only one advice, it will be stop, think before you act. That would be one advice.
And that, for a lot of people, will be a novel idea because they naturally click on something without thinking first.
Exactly. A lot of these things happen because of the momentary lapse of judgment or momentary thing that we do, right? So that is one advice, if I have to just summarize and give only one advice.
To you, we thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you very much, Mike. It has been wonderful.
That was Tehu Hayrath, a professor of information systems in the Goodman School of Business at Brock, on how to spot and deal with phishing scams in your daily email and social media feeds. Brock University's Special Collections and Archives has begun collecting materials for a new archive on a neurological disorder that affects one out of every 100 children in Canada, Autism Spectrum Disorder, or ASD. The collection was quietly launched at Brock earlier this year, spearheaded by David Sharon, head of Special Collections and Archives at the James A. Gibson Library at Brock. David, you might recall, was on Inquisitive Minds last fall, talking about the War of 1812 exhibit currently on display at the St. Catharines Museum. David takes more than a passing interest in ASD himself, as he is the father of two sons diagnosed with ASD more than 5 years ago. David joined us in our CFBU-FM studios recently to talk about the collection and how you can contribute your information to their special collection.
It really started years ago. I was talking to my supervisor just at an annual review, and she asked one day, what would you like to collect if you can collect anything in the world? And, you know, you have ideas and you think of things all the time. And for a while, I had been reading a lot about autism for personal reasons. And I said, there's a lot of amazing subjects and topics and directions to go with this. And I don't think anyone else is doing it. So I thought about it. And then the opportunity came up to do something different with our archival collection and look for new avenues. And we could either do something that other universities have already done and done well, or do something new that no one's explored yet. So luckily, the university librarian said, let's do something new, and I got the green light to go.
Now, is this something you ever done before, create a project like this literally from scratch? Because that's a daunting task.
No, it's a rare occasion where you have an opportunity to go after a subject, especially when you're in an established archives program like we have. For 45 years plus, we've been collecting Niagara history and doing a great job with it. But this is a new opportunity to do something different. You look at the other schools, they're doing literature, women's issues, labor issues. Like, those are all big topics that have all been nailed down. So, yeah, to do something like this is new. It is exciting, and there's a lot of work. There's so many possibilities to go from. Sometimes it's hard to say, where do we begin?
Well, where do you begin? You have to start from scratch, as we say. So you basically know what's required of you to do this. So how daunting was it when you laid out the groundwork saying, this is what I have to do, and you know the end result is wherever down the road? How complicated was it to get this set up and get the word out that this is going, and it's basically your ball of wax, for want of a better expression?
Yeah, in your own mind, it sounds like a great idea, but then we had to look internally to see if this would even fly at Brock. So I had to survey the faculty members at Brock and see who's working on subjects like autism. And surprisingly, there are 8 professors who listed autism as one of their primary research topics. And then there are 7 others who have topics of study that relate very closely to autism and can spin off easily into that realm. So internally, it sounded great. And then it was like, okay, there's people at Brock who can use this material. And that's key for anything. It's no point collecting if no one's going to use it. And then it was a matter of, okay, who would we want in the archives? And it's just a matter of going through the literature and searching the web and seeing what's out there. And I started big. I wrote the 4 of some of the biggest names in autism in North America, and 2 of them responded within 2 weeks of me asking. And one of them was Temple Grandin, and she became the first person to donate to the collection, and it just blew my mind.
So it's a very much a collaborative effort when you go to the other people at Brock and you're going outside of Brock. You can't do this all on your own, obviously. So the support is there, and that's encouraging. What are you looking for, basically?
Yeah, archives can be anything, any kind of recorded medium. So we're looking for diaries, letters. We're getting a lot of electronic records like blogs, and email is a possibility. Photography. Autism goes in so many directions. There's research data. There's rare reports and books that are out there. Anything that records the history or documents autism in any way, that's really what we're looking for. We're not so much looking for published works, but that one of a kind, if this disappears, there's no replacing it type of archival special record. That's what we're really looking for. And we're looking for what it's like to have autism, what it's like to have children with autism or a sibling with autism. What's it like to be a therapist working with autistic people? Anything. The organizations who are out there who promote people with autism and social justice, and how they have a voice of their own. There's great organizations who are promoting autism, don't tell us what we need to do. We're here, and let us speak for ourselves. And there's so many directions, politicians, doctors, there's so many people involved with it. And people with autism can be some of the most talented and interesting people in the world. And what are they thinking? What are they experiencing? What's their careers been like? There's so many different directions, and that's the most exciting. And the most daunting part of it is, who do you pick and where do you start? So we picked a few to start with, and you know, we hope word of mouth gets out there where it kind of takes off on its own.
So really anyone who has experienced ASD in some way is encouraged to contribute then?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. There must be guidelines as to what is permissible. Mm-hmm. Now you say like a lot of it is digital and some of it is hard copy. It's whatever you've got that you may want to contribute. But there must be some kind of guidelines or ground rules in place so that you don't just collect anything and everything.
Yeah, there's always limits to any archival collection, and one of the biggest limits is space. How much can we take in? And you want to say yes to everything, but it's just not a reality. So we did come up with a collection policy, and we narrowed it down to 5 subject areas within autism that we wanted to collect. So anything that documents the lives of people with or working with autism, the organizations and businesses that deal with autism themes, autism in pop culture. You're starting to see it on TV and books and movies. It's popping up everywhere. So how is the representation of autism in popular culture? Any scientific research data that is not being archived anywhere else, if someone needs to put it somewhere, we'd like them to think of Brock. And this is the one that the faculty members suggested to me when I kind of surveyed them, is there are rare government documents, books that are very difficult to find, things that have happened years and years ago, even before autism was really a mainstream issue, and they're just disappearing. People throw out things without thinking, and if we can collect these rare policies and regulations and books, they would really appreciate that. So we added that as our 5th subject area. And then within there, there's parameters on what we would collect. So we're thinking big. We're looking at Canada and the United States. We're not just going to limit ourselves to just our local area. Well, we're saying if no one else is doing this, we're going to be the place in Canada and the United States that collects this. So we're going big.
Would it be easier to take a look at what you're not looking for as far as the collection is concerned? I mean, you have to set up those guidelines, as you say, but what would you not be looking for?
That is tough because I'm very excited about doing this, and I wouldn't want to say no to anything, but sometimes there are just things that don't fit. Sometimes people with autism can be very obsessive about what they collect and maintain, and I've heard stories about people with volumes of scrapbooking that they do. They love a topic so much, and they collect everything on it, and then you end up with 35 boxes of New York Yankees uniform pictures, and it just goes on and on and on. And it's interesting in the sense that why are they focused on this and what drives them to collect materials like that? But it becomes a space issue. It's like, we can't take this in. Maybe one representative portion of it, because it is an important part of that person's life. But to take in a massive volume of materials that it tells part of the story, but not the whole story. So we just want a representative part. That might be something we'd have to negotiate. There's situations like that that make you just put the policy in order where you have a right to say no. And it's really a judgment call on my part and the library's part to say, thank you very much. We really appreciate your interest, but this is kind of outside of our collection scope.
Yeah, you don't want to discourage anyone.
No.
But I guess you're in a situation like that, you can say, well, we could really make use of this, but find some diplomatic way to not accept everything.
It's a very important part of the job, is learning how to say no politely, and as well as maybe suggesting another place that might really want that.
So exactly.
We do try to help people. If we don't take it, we try to help them find a place that would.
Now, you mentioned that you've already had some response within a couple of weeks of deciding to undertake this project. Since then, so far, how's the response been?
We have 6 collections now, and it's been about a year, so it's been very good, I would say, just because we're going by word of mouth, and I write a lot of people. We're probably only getting a 10% response, whether the response is, yes, I have something for you, or that's a great idea, but I've never considered this. I'm not ready to donate anything, but we'll keep in mind, and maybe in 15 years, we'll be donating something. And that's just nice to hear that people are enthused about it. And we always say, tell your friends if there's anyone out there. So we have 6 collections right now, and I think it's a really good start. And this is the year we really want to push out and say, okay, we have a base and what can be added to it. And autism really started taking off through the 70s and 80s, a study of it. Those professionals are starting to retire. And what did they collect over their careers? And maybe they're at that point in time in their life where they say, oh, I have all this great stuff, but where do I put it? Well, why not donate it to Brock and have those records have a second life? And maybe someone else can take it and run with what they've studied. And of course, there's always people who have to live with autism in some way every day. And, you know, we accept that as well. So there's a lot of potential out there still.
Contributions, they are coming in, but do you actively have to pursue leads to track down collections, or are they finding you through word of mouth and some form of network that, by the way, you may want to get in touch with Brock University. They've got this special collection. They're looking for material. How much do you have to track down these collections?
Yeah, it's been a little bit of both. So right off the bat, every time I read something about autism, I would write it down in a book. And once a week, I'd pick one or two names and just write a cold email or a formal letter and just send them out our policy, our mission, and what we're doing, and just say, we're out here. What do you think of this? Do you think you have anything that you'd like to donate? And that's how we got our first couple donors. And then out of the blue, we had one person who ended up getting us two donations say, I have heard about what you're doing and we'd like to contribute and help. And that was fantastic. They put our initiative out on their listserv. And so we got two donations out of that. And somehow someone from England just contacted us and just say, I heard what you're doing and I think it's great, and we're not collecting anything from England, and he wasn't even offering anything. He just said it was a really neat idea. So somehow the word's getting out there, and that's encouraging. And the faculty members at Brock gave me a whole bunch of names of people I should chase after, and I followed up on those, and we hope to get some greater exposure with some archival groups like Archives Ontario. One of the board members of Brock is also a member of the executive of Autism Ontario, so he's working on our behalf, telling people what we're doing, so it's neat to see it grow that way.
Yeah, I was wondering just how far-ranging collecting would go, and you say you're not collecting from international sources. What if someone, for example, from some far-flung European country wants to contribute? Are they okay to contribute?
Right now, the collection policy is just Canada and United States.
I see, okay.
Oh, maybe there's a school in Europe that would say, oh, that's a great idea. We can do that too. And hopefully there's a center who would collect in England or France or just take care of their own countries or go broader. But just scope-wise, thinking globally is just huge. And I think we're thinking very big with just Canada and United States. There's so much potential there. It'd be enough to keep us busy for years and years.
Oh, for sure, yeah. But it's nice, as you say, that you're getting this attention from, for example, the UK. That's the internet at play, because it would have been much more difficult, say, 20 years ago at the birth of the internet, to get the word out and have people find out about it and respond so quickly to what you're doing in other parts of the world. So it's probably going to be a little bit easier for you, even on a local level, to track down collections than it might have been many, many years ago before electronic media was so pervasive and all around us.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And just the ability for me to get a name and find an email address associated with that name saves a lot on postage. And just to say, this is something that we're doing, and to get a response within a day or two from that person just saying, great idea, I don't have anything, perfectly fine, but they might tell someone, and it just really makes it go quicker. I mean, it also is a little scary in a sense that information does travel so fast. All of a sudden, you know, we're just waiting for the deluge of requests to come in, and it's like, oh, now we have to manage all this plus all the other good things that we're trying to do up in the special collections and archives. But, you know, we're ready for that too, and there's nothing wrong with a lot of work.
Now, I wanted to talk about how this all started for you, because I understand you've experienced firsthand what it's like to live with not one but two autistic children, right?
Yes. Yes, I have twin boys with autism.
When they were diagnosed, what was your first reaction to the news? Because I'm curious how a parent would handle the news when they're told this is the situation. What's your first reaction?
It was sad. You know, you have a certain idea of what your child's life is going to be like. And when we got the diagnosis, well, at first, yeah, it's like, wow, everything I thought of is just different. And there's going to be struggles. And, you know, that's a reality. And it was very upsetting. But luckily for both my wife and I, we just said, okay, we're upset, but this can't last. We have to be here for the kids and do what's best for them. And we got to move on, find out what works for them, and just go from there. So eventually, the day we got the diagnosis became a good thing, because before we knew there was something that was different about the boys. And we had no idea what it was. And we tried a whole bunch of different things to just help them in their development moving forward. And then to know what the issue is and to know what you can do about it. It was actually after the initial shock of, okay, there's a name to this issue that we're dealing with. It's like, okay, now we know who to talk to get help and support, and what kind of therapies work best for these guys, and how do you manage life around these kids and get them involved, and what will help them succeed. And, you know, it was a sad day from one point of view, but at the other, it was very liberating when you can say, now I know I have a direction to go. And that's where we went, and the boys have done great since. So yeah, it was a mixed emotions, obviously, but they've done very well since.
You strike me as being a rather pragmatic individual, and when this challenge is presented to you, you do the best you possibly can under the circumstances. I'm just wondering if at some point, this is going to be a difficult question to ask, and you cannot answer it if you choose to, but I'm wondering if at some point there might be a fleeting moment of anger when you get the news. Why did this happen to us? Do you ever think that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's just natural to think that. But I think it is just the pragmatic's a good word of both my wife and I. It's like, well, there's nothing we can do to reverse it, in a sense, without just some good therapy and things to help get them over some of their hurdles. So we decided not to dwell on why and decided to go on what we need to do to make things better and get them the help that they needed. And that's always been our direction. So there's times when you want to think about it, or you read about a researcher who's doing genetics and trying to figure out why autism is on the rise these days. And you kind of think back, oh, well, that may have been our case, maybe not. And for a while you think about it and think about what you did in those first years as a parent. And it's almost fortunate we don't know what the causes of autism now. I don't know if I'd want the guilt of knowing. So it's just better to say we live in the present and looking forward to the future, and what's happened happened, and we're moving forward, and we don't want to dwell on why. We want to just make things as good as possible.
So what's life like at home now? Is there anything that's significantly different from what any other family might experience in a family setting?
I think we're really, really fortunate that we have twin boys, and I think that's the greatest blessing we ever got. Autism, it's a disorder, and it affects the socialization of the people who have it. And because they're identical twin brothers, they had to socialize with each other. It was before birth they were together, and they have a great connection with each other, and they play, and they've been able to develop their social skills through themselves. And they have an older sister who's just been wonderful and a blessing as well. So they've all grown up together, and they've developed those social skills that are sometimes lacking in people with autism. And so they still have their struggles. They still have things that it's hard for them to grasp and understand. But we hopefully, I think we're doing our best to try to have them have all the opportunities of any other child. And when they need help, we have to be their advocates, whether it's at school or beyond school. We have to be the people who stand up and say, you know what, this is the reason why my child is acting or behaving the way they are, and this is a way that we can all help him move forward and enjoy his time and benefit. So for us, we just had to learn to be more proactive about where our kids are going and who's aware of what their needs may be. But I think we've been very fortunate with the severity of their autism. It's not as bad as other situations. So we've always felt very lucky for that.
You weren't in this alone, you and your wife. There were support mechanisms in place in Niagara that you were able to tap into in order to get the information you would need to deal with this new experience for you, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. Our first phone call once the diagnosis came in was to the local chapter of Autism Ontario, and they just gave us literature to read and say, oh, there's this group that's forming over here where parents can talk to other parents. There's therapy sessions that you can bring your children to help them with language or socialization. And then they gave you the path that you'd need to get some of the more therapeutic needs. So it's like, oh, you need to call this place to get on the waiting list for this type of therapy. And then there's occupational therapy, speech therapy, social groups. And they just laid out a path, and we did our best to hit those. So our boys have gone to therapies at Bethesda and the Niagara Peninsula Children's Center. And, you know, there are the social groups. And from there, there is a great network of people here in Niagara who are there to help and are very good at what they do. And without them, yeah, you're kind of rudderless without those supports locally, and gets bigger when you get to Ontario. So it is very important to tap into the local community and what services are available to you.
You can make a good life with your family because of the information and the support that's there.
Yes, there's wonderful people out there who care a lot about these children and adults. It doesn't go away at all. It's for adults, children, even support groups for the people who live with these people. So we're very fortunate in the Niagara area to have such a strong network of people.
So how old are they now?
The boys are 10.
Boys are 10?
Yes.
So what grade? I'm trying to think. 10?
Grade 5.
Grade 5?
Yes.
Getting back to the collecting of material for the special collection, how can people get involved if they want to help and contribute to this special collection abroad?
Sure. We do have a website. So if you just Google search Autism Collection Brock University, probably the easiest way to find it, because I can't even say the website off the top of my head. Or they can contact me in the Special Collections and Archives. I'm in the directory of the library, easy to find, or just call the Brock switchboard and ask for David Sharon and can get to me. Or my email address is dsharon@brocku.ca, and I'd be thrilled to hear from anyone who has something that they think might be suitable for the collection, or just say, oh, I know someone who has something that you may be interested in, and I'll follow up on a lead and appreciate any help we can get.
So would some or all, although I can't imagine all, but at least some of the material that you collect be available to view by the public at some point? Obviously not while you're collecting it, but is that anticipated at some point that it might be some kind of a public collection that people would be able to tap into as a resource for themselves?
Yeah, that's a great question. The materials that we collect, we do see our students using, faculty, outside researchers. So the person who donates has to be aware that this is going to be looked at by other people, because there are probably some personal things in these type of collections, especially medical information and things like that. There are things that can be negotiated to close a certain part of the collection for certain amount of years and things like that. But in general, we can't just be a storage place for records that'll never be seen. They have to have kind of an active purpose at the university. And so any donor should be willing to allow these things to be viewed by other people.
So do you have any advice, or is there a message that you might want to offer to other parents, since you've experienced this yourselves? Say you're dealing with raising an autistic child. Here's maybe something that I can offer you so that you better understand and know what you're doing in the future. What advice can you offer them?
Wow. What worked for us is just, it's okay to feel your feelings, but you're there for the child and do what you can to move the child forward in their development, find out what their weaknesses are and work hard to build those skills up. And what we found what works is working with people. It's sometimes you get mad at someone who just doesn't understand it, and being confrontational usually doesn't help anybody in the very end. Sometimes you do have to really put your foot down and just say, this is what my child needs, and that's what your role is as a parent. But it's better to work with people than against it, and hopefully most situations allow for that to occur. So it's worked well for us. We get great support from the boys' school. They're absolutely fantastic. They have been to us for the last 6 years, and very encouraging and flexible from what we found. And just tap into the community. There's a great wealth of knowledge out there. Talk to other parents and see what works for them. Don't be afraid to try something. Every child is different. Sometimes things work and sometimes they don't. And sometimes it might take years for something to finally break through and never give up because they're your kids and you can't be the one to give up on them.
David, I admire you and your wife for all that you've done with your two children. What are the names, by the way?
Alex and Nick.
Excellent. Congratulations to all of you. Thank you very much for coming in and telling us about this. And I wish you the very best with your family, but also with this collection. I think it's a wonderful project that you've undertaken. Truly, I think this will be a labor of love for you because you have more than a vested interest in it. But I appreciate you coming in and telling us about it today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike.
That was David Sharon, head of Special Collections and Archives at the James A. Gibson Library at Brock. On a new archive, they are collecting material for on Autism Spectrum Disorder, or ASD. Earlier this year, we told you about the We Teach Ontario video contest held by the Ontario Confederation of University Faculty Associations. We spoke with communications manager for the OCUFA, Graham Stewart, on the January 29th edition of Inquisitive Minds, you might recall. Well, the competition closed in February, and a Brock grad student by the name of Brittany Dunbar was the grand prize winner. Brittany won an iPhone 5S and was able to attend the annual OCUFA conference in Toronto held at the end of February. I invited Brittany into the CFPU studios recently to talk about her video, why she chose her supervisor Brian Roy as her video subject, and of course, how he was impacted her chosen field of study. Brittany made the decision to become a Master of Science student in kinesiology at Brock. I asked Brittany first about the significance of winning the award.
It was something that was pretty important to me. I mean, it's great to put myself, my supervisor, and Brock University as a whole out there and to get recognized for things that we're doing. I mean, in my video, I included the fact that we have a new, beautiful facility that we get to do our research in, and I think that's something that's really good to showcase.
Your video submission documented your decision to become a Master of Science student in kinesiology under Supervisor Brian Roy, right?
Right, yeah.
Now, before you met Professor Roy, were you undecided on your academic career path, or did he simply reinforce the direction that you felt your academic career would take?
Yeah, I really had no clear-cut path of what I wanted to do after I was done my 4 years at Brock. I thought I wanted to do Master of Physio, maybe a graduate program in a college, but it wasn't until doing independent study my fourth year that I was open to the possibility of doing research and staying at Brock. So I think I made the right decision in the end.
Now tell me about the video, because when I discussed the contest in January with Graham Stewart of the OCUFA, he really didn't know what form the videos would take. He really didn't know how long they would be, how elaborate they would be. So he was looking forward to seeing a lot of the submissions. So what did you do and how did you go about recording it?
I sort of took the method of get to the point, short or sweet. I mean, there were some videos that were long. There were some that were shorter than mine. People only want to watch things for so long, you know, like 3 minutes was, I felt, the maximum that I could deliver the information I wanted to and still make it short enough that people would want to watch the whole thing and not get bored halfway through or something.
Brevity is a virtue, and
yep.
Sometimes fewer words say more than a whole pile of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you were able to see some of the other submissions then?
Before I submitted mine, there was a couple online already, and then after I submitted mine, a couple more showed up towards the end of the contest. So I did watch all of them just to see, you know, curiosity. But yeah, I mean, there was some really great videos on there besides mine.
Now, it must be a good feeling knowing that your video has had an impact on others, much as Dr. Roy has had a real impact on you.
Yeah, like, I mean, at the conference, people approached me saying, oh, I was just like you when I was younger. I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I had that professor who just made an impact on me, and it was a really great feeling that other people could relate to something that I was going through.
Yeah, and that's an important thing, because when you get to university, you don't always know at the end of that where you want to be.
Yeah.
So you're relying on the professors, the supervisors who are guiding your academic career to help you with that.
Yeah.
So that relationship between you and the professor is very important. And if it works well, that's significant.
Yeah, I mean, there's some people who know they're going to go do their undergrad and then they're going to go to law school. They're going to go on to do other things. But for people like me, it's kind of nice that, you know, you just find your way through your undergrad degree. And I think it's amazing that universities can do this to students like myself. I start off by saying I had it as a second year for one of my undergrad courses. And then it wasn't until fourth year that I approached him to do an independent study. I did that for the first semester. And then I realized, maybe I want to stay with Brian Roy and move forward in my academics and pursue a master's degree.
Now, did you tell Dr. Roy that you were going to be doing the video submission?
Yeah, I sent him an email, asked him sort of for permission to make sure that it was okay that I include him in it. You know, I didn't want to step on any boundaries or anything. So I made sure it was all okay, and he said go for it. So I did. I ran with it.
He was happy about it?
Yeah, oh yeah, he was thrilled.
Did you pre-screen it before you submitted it? Did he get a chance to see it before you actually put the submission in?
No. Maybe that could have been a good idea, but no, I just put it up online and hope for the best.
And what was his reaction once he finally got to see it?
I think he liked it. Yeah, yeah, he was pleased.
Okay. All right. Now, beyond the video, as a student, how much can that particular professor influence your academic life?
I think it has to go both ways. Like, the student needs to approach the professor, and the professors just need to be open to having students approach them. I mean, there could be some professors who don't really interact with their students, but someone like Dr. Roy or like other people who have had an undergrad degree are just really connected to their students. They love what they're doing. And I think if they love what they're doing, then us as students love what we're doing. And I think that builds a positive relationship everywhere in the university.
Now, as the top prize winner, you were able to go to the conference that was held the last weekend of February in Toronto, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
How was the conference? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, they talked about some really interesting things just about how we can change the universities to be better. I mean, it was titled the Future You Conference. I think that title was super fitting. The theme was brought back consistently through topics that people were talking about. And I got to meet a variety of people from a variety of different areas of a university. There was people from the faculty. There was just your staff, your librarians, students representing the student body population. There was just so many different people there.
So how many people all told would you say were attending the conference?
About 120 or so, I'd say total.
Okay, now these are from all different universities across the province or beyond that?
Majority of them were across the province, and then there was a few people from the East Coast and the West Coast, and a couple American professors, and then there was one lady from the UK as well who came in and talked about the differences between the UK and Canadian universities.
Now you obviously had a chance to talk to a lot of people. That must have been a nice and inspiring experience for you to talk to all of these educators and other people, professionals and academics from so many different walks of life, so many different universities, and as you say, from places as far away as the UK.
Yeah, it was nice to get their story or ask them about how they got to where they are as well. I was able to pick up the brains of a few people, like at lunchtime, the former president of Trent University sat beside me. So, I mean, that was pretty cool to sit and talk to her about different things or just general table discussion. It was interesting.
Now, tell me about some of the research you're doing at Brock, because you're looking at muscle metabolism, I understand.
That's correct.
So specifically, what are you looking at?
So basically, we're sort of taking a different approach. It's not really common yet. We are working with cells. So we make up some cells that resemble human muscle, which is pretty cool. And then we're just going to look at different stress levels of when it's under, I'll use layman terms, lots of water in the muscle versus not enough. So like hydration versus dehydration sort of states in the muscle. And specifically, we're looking at like the protein content. And I mean, we all know go lift weights, you need the protein, but we're looking at a little bit more specific component of it.
I was thinking like without the protein, your muscles are just not going to function properly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the water content, that will vary then.
Yeah, absolutely, depending on what you're doing and how much you're drinking every day, too.
Now, is that through, like, sweating when you're working out? Your water level is dropping, and that's why you're trying to rehydrate yourself?
It's definitely part of the reason. I mean, there's so many things that go on in the human body that every little variance can change something else. So, like I said, like, we're just looking at a specific part of, like, the muscles and hopefully see what kind of performance we can get out of it.
So how does protein affect muscle tissue, then?
Basically, we need the protein to build upon the muscle. Like when we work out, we break down our muscle and the protein comes in and helps to repair and replenish the muscles that have just been under a lot of stress. So, I mean, talking within my research, we're going to kind of see what different levels of fluid within the muscle, if it changes, what can we add to diminish those changes overall.
Does the muscle mass affect it in any way? In other words, if you're working out a lot and you're really building up your muscles, as opposed to someone who's, for want of a better expression, a couch potato and not working out at all, and their muscles are different, the different development makeup of the muscles, does that affect it at all?
I haven't really looked into that, but I could imagine that it's not too much, because your body, it's not like you wake up the next day with an extra 4 pounds of muscle. You slowly build up to it, so your body will learn to slowly adapt to the ever-changingness of our bodies.
Are you planning to continue the research that you've been doing on this, or you're going to move on to something else?
No, I haven't really fully got into my thesis yet. Being like a first-year master's student, I mean, we're still reading through the literature, still testing testing out theories and whatnot and just getting our hands dirty. And then eventually we'll write our thesis, and then I'll be working on that over the summer before defending my thesis.
I've heard about defending the thesis. Does that sound at all daunting for you at all?
A little bit. I mean, I've seen a couple of my colleagues go through theirs, and there'll be a lot of preparation for sure. But I mean, I'm still in the early stages. I don't need to worry about that just yet.
So that sounds like an exciting summer for you if you're going to be preparing for your thesis.
Yeah, exactly.
So where do you go from here? What do you plan to do with your life beyond university?
That's the million-dollar question. I will try and probably find a job, hopefully right after I'm done my master's. If not, I'm definitely open to the opportunity to go back to school to do like a college graduate program. Like I said, that I would have maybe done right after my undergrad, but with opportunities coming up, I decided to do my master's instead. Yeah, it's hard to say where I'll end up. You hear about other people who graduate and a job just happened to fall on their lap. I think everyone's hoping for that. But I mean, we obviously all need to work hard and just see where life takes us.
But would you like to stay at Brock University if an opportunity presented itself for you to continue?
Yeah, I would definitely be open to that. I mean, I've built a great relationship with my fellow colleagues and the professors and whatnot, so it's definitely a place I feel comfortable.
The fact that Brock is celebrating his 50th anniversary this year. I've talked to a lot of people about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice celebration, but it's interesting because in the overall scheme of things, Brock is not an old university.
No.
There are universities around that for hundreds of years they've been educating students. So in the overall scheme of things, Brock is a very young university. Although this is a real milestone. So it must be nice for you to be a part of that, their 50th anniversary year, and you're there, you're learning right as they're celebrating their anniversary this year. So you're a bit of that anniversary celebration yourself.
Yeah, that's true. I guess I've never really thought of it like that, but absolutely. Yeah.
So you're continuing your work. You'll be doing your thesis defense, presumably in the fall, and then you'll see where life takes you after that.
Yep. I mean, I'm big into triathlon, so if I can just live the life and race for a little bit before getting a job, that'd be fun too.
You're always running.
Yes.
More or less, you're one way or another.
Always doing something, running. Yeah.
Brittany, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a pleasure to meet you, and congratulations on winning the We Teach Ontario contest. And I'm sure that Dr. Roy and everyone else on staff in kinesiology and beyond are very proud of you and happy with your accomplishment.
No, thank you very much.
There we heard from Brock grad student Brittany Dunbar, a Master of Science student in kinesiology, who was so inspired by her supervisor, Dr. Roy, she decided to enter the OCUFA We Teach Ontario video contest earlier this year and was the grand prize winner. Congratulations to Brittany and Brian as well. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. Thank you.